today at Reader's Corner, Terry Hayes, author of the acclaimed new thriller, The Year of the Locust. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On today's program, novelist Terry Hayes joins us to talk about his new adventure novel, The Year of the Locust. The book follows CIA spy Ridley Walker, codename Kane, as he travels to the violent borders of Pakistan, Iran, and Afghanistan. Tasked with exfiltrating a man with vital information for the safety of the West, he meets an adversary who will take the world to the brink of extinction. Terry Hayes is a former journalist, screenwriter, producer, who has won over 20 film and television awards. His work includes movies you've heard of, Payback, The Road Warrior, and Dead Calm. I haven't forgotten that one. His previous novel, I Am Pilgrim, was an international bestseller, nor have I forgotten that one, and I have no doubt The Year of the Locust is as well. Terry Hayes, talking to us all the way from Lisbon, Portugal. Welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much for giving me your time.
Well, Terry, did you notice that I called your book, instead of a thriller, which is what the front cover of the book says, an adventure novel? And frankly, I stole that from you, because in listening to you talk with someone else who was reviewing your book, you point out that, well, the spy genre is what? I'll let you fill in the words from there.
Yeah, well, the spy genre can be pretty musty, you know. It tends to use very similar tropes, and we all know what happens, you know. Bad guy comes along carrying axe and beheading people at every given opportunity, and some intelligence agency, it can be the CIA, it can be MI6 in England, can be Mossad, can't be the Australian intelligence agency, because that's a complete contradiction in terms, Australia and intelligence. Just kidding. I love the country. Somebody from some intelligence agency now has to go and pursue the madman. And it's very unusual for the good guy to get killed at the end. I certainly have never done that. So we all know how it's going to end. So, you know, you've got to mix it up. You've got to try new things. An Australian a film critic for Time magazine in its heyday wrote a book and did a whole TV series called The Shock of the New. And what he was basically saying was that we'd all be watching Madonna with Child, looking at paintings of Madonna with Child, of which I can guarantee you I've seen at least 10,000. We'd all be looking at that. If people involved in a creative life do not embrace the shock of the new. So you can imagine what it was like when abstraction first started,
right,
or surrealism, or any number of other art movements. I mean, I was in a museum in Amsterdam a week ago, looking at all the great Velasquezes and all, you know, all the very traditional great artists and that, Rembrandts and all of that. And in the middle of it, they put a Picasso portrait. Talk about the shock of the new. It was painted in, you know, I don't know for sure, but about 1919. Everything else had been painted in 1640. And it was totally arresting to stand there and look at this. And that. So if you want to do spy novels, in my view, you got to try something different. You got to mix it up. And as you said, it's more of an adventure story, I think, than a spy thriller, but it has all the elements of a spy thriller.
Well, what I found so absolutely fascinating about the book, and it's just one of the best I've read in a very long time, and I can't recommend it more highly to our listeners. I'm going along reading the book as though it is a spy thriller. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I get 2/3 of the way through or whatever it is, and I'm just yanked out of my reality as I'm following these characters, because it changes rather dramatically and becomes some form of, I guess you'd call it speculative fiction or yes, science fiction, wouldn't you?
Yeah, speculative fiction, yeah. I think. You know, both my earlier novel, I Am Pilgrim, and Locust, hopefully intelligently, I'm not sure, others can be the judge of that, but hopefully deals intelligently with what's called over the horizon science. It's coming, but we can't quite see it yet. And that, so in Pilgrim, that was over the horizon science, was the recreation of the smallpox virus from genetic letters that you can basically buy on the internet. Now, just as the book was being published, a group of scientists in upstate New York did exactly that with the polio virus. They recreated it basically from just genetic letters you can buy. Now, if you can do it with polio, which I think has somewhere around 30,000 genetic letters, and smallpox has 187,000 genetic letters, the degree of difficulty is a lot more. But the proof of principle had already been undertaken. You can do it. Right. Well, in Locus, the over-the-horizon science is cloaking technology, which is a stealth on steroids. A month after the book was completed, the US Air Force lost one of its stealth fighters. It crashed, but they couldn't find it. They couldn't find it because the stealth was so good on it, they weren't quite sure what had happened. Now, cloaking technology is a step beyond that. It is the very thing that every military research organization of any real weight and talent is looking at, because whoever solves that is going to be able to mask anything on the battlefield, anything at all. Mm-hmm. And in my case, what gets masked is a submarine. And I chose a submarine because, there's this saying, there's two types of warships, submarines and targets. Submarines are the best weapons platform in the world. And no aircraft carrier can match what a submarine can really do. So if you cloak one, it's total game changer. So I did that. And then I'm also interested in off-earth mining, which is what, SpaceX and all the rest of the commercial space projects are really about. It's not about taking tourists to Mars. I mean, God almighty, if you want to go there, you can go to the Mojave Desert and go to the center of Australia. You don't have to go to Mars. You can go to Death Valley if you want. And so I managed, I don't know how successfully, but to draw all of those things together and frame it in an adventure story. And you're right, it does change up a real gear. And that worried me. I thought, this is really bold, but if they can go with the characters and they can make believe with me, I think it really pays off at the end. I think the end is very, very emotional. Mm-hmm. I can't say too much more, Bob, because I don't want to give away too many spoilers. That's your job.
Right. Well, we have a rule here on Reader's Corner, no spoilers. We're gonna prevent that. I want to get back to I Am Pilgrim for a minute, because that's when I first learned of your great work, when I read that book. And at the time, I was still in office in the president's office at Boise State. And I recommended that book to everybody around me.
Well,
and as a matter of fact, and then when this one came out and I heard about it, I had to go back and find all of them and let them know, hey, we've got a new one here and you've got to get your hands on it. But as I understand it, this book is soon to be something else, or maybe not soon, but at least there's a work in progress on some kind of film.
On Pilgrim? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. That's correct. I spent a lot of my life in Hollywood, so nothing surprises me, nothing at all. But even I was a bit taken aback that MGM bought the rights about 9 years ago to Pilgrim. And MGM at that stage was run by two people I know very well, and I would count as friends. So I had faith in their taste. I'd worked with them before. So I had real faith in it. So, of course, this is Hollywood, So
right.
They tell me, it's on the fast track. It's going to be a really good feature film. We're going first class with it. Just hold tight. Well, of course, they got fired because, that's what happens in Hollywood. But we got a new team in, Michael DeLuca, who I know and is a very highly accomplished film producer. He started to run MGM. So he called me up and he said, Terry, it's a great book. It's on the fast track. We're going to go first class with it. Hold tight. I said, oh, good. So he left. And then we got a new guy in who had been the head of MGM Television. So he called me up and he said, it's a great book. It's on the fast track. We're going to go first class, hold tight. Then he got fired. Now we're with Amazon. So they called me up. Well, I don't have to tell you by what they said to me. So I've been through four administrations, and each one of them was determined to make the film, and each one ended up with them leaving. Well, not at Amazon yet, but the unfortunate fact for them is that these contracts for film rights are sometimes, not always, but sometimes time limited, and the rights revert to me in another 5 or 6 months. And and we've had such interest from the Hollywood community in purchasing it that I'm very confident. And one of the people that's shown interest over many years is a very highly acclaimed director. And he calls me up every few months and talks to me about it. So and maybe he will commit to making it. If not, somebody else will. So I think that when MGM bought it, it was nothing more than the promise of a big selling book, you know, and a relatively well-told story, I guess. But now, after the passage of all these years, the book sold, I think, over 5 million copies. It's one of those stories that, for whatever reason, seems to stick to people's bones. They seem to remember it. They seem to reread it. And so, you know, Hollywood's not known for original thinking, that's for sure. And they look at this and they say, oh, my God.
Right.
This has got some future. So I think that's what's going to happen. Yeah, I think, the question is who's going to play Pilgrim, you know, and I'm not available, so they're going to have to look around.
You're listening to Terry Hayes. He's the author of the thriller and the adventure novel, The Year of the Locust, but we've been talking about I Am Pilgrim, which he wrote in 2014, and I strongly recommend getting a copy of that as well. They're both excellent. But while we're on the subject of writing a screenplay or Hollywood, as you said, you've spent many years there, tell us the difference between writing a novel and writing a screenplay. How does that work?
The big difference is about 30 people, in my estimation. You write a screenplay, and of course, everybody's an expert. You got at the studios. Not everybody at the studios is stupid, but a fair number are. And you know, you get young men and women, or you know, very very ambitious young men and women who might have dreamed of a career on Wall Street and found out how boring it is. So they go to Hollywood, and in some cases, they haven't read anything. You find that out very quickly, that when you're in these meetings and you make a reference to something in a written form, they look at you sort of blankly. Now, nobody likes to admit that they're, you know, not well informed, but, you know, I'm talking about, you know, Hemingway, things like this, you know. you might say, oh, well, you know, it was a great scene in For Whom the Bell Tolls. And they look at you and they think, that sounds religious. I don't know whether we want to go there. Their main reference points are filmed entertainment. It never used to be that way. Back in the golden era, Hollywood was mining a huge repository of stories that have been written as books or novellas, some of them good, some of them not so good. But, you know, you and I could name 10,000 movies that have been drawn from books, everything from, you know, The Count of Monte Cristo, you know, right the way through to Gone with the Wind and everything in between. But now their reference points are other movies. So you sit there with a whole lot of people arguing about something you're all discussing, something you've written. And everybody has an opinion. And one of the great skills in Hollywood is diplomacy. It's very frustrating. But when you get up on your hind legs and tell people that they're stupid, well, you don't stay on the project very long, you know. And that when you're writing a novel, you've only got one idiot to deal with, yourself. And that is a whole lot easier than, 30 people of 12 of whom are complete idiots. Everybody thinks they've got the answer. And I always used to say, when you go into these meetings, that listen to them because they will tell you what doesn't work. Never listen to any of the solutions. They have no idea of narrative storytelling, no idea of the complexity between character, plot, emotion, where the audience is, a rhythm of information. They don't know any of that stuff. Okay. When you're writing a novel, you have to know all of that and you have to implement it on a minute by minute basis. So it's lonely writing a novel. You get very uncertain of yourself. You know, you're a few hundred pages in and you think this is terrible, but I can't abandon it. There's nobody except maybe your wife or your kids, your partner, your life partner, to tell you how you're going. Whereas with a screenplay, you know, they frequently ask you to feed them pages 10 at a time, or you've got a director there who will at least encourage you. But then you have to deal with the studio. Then you have to deal with the marketing people. Then you have to deal with a whole host of other people. And then, you know, a few weeks before production, they say, oh, well, it's budgeted in at 120 million. It's got to come in under 100. What are you going to cut? Whereas, you know, I write a novel. I don't cut anything unless I think it's to the benefit of the story. So Hollywood, you get incredibly well paid and it's a miserable life. Writing novels, you don't get nearly as well paid. I've been very fortunate, but generally you don't. But it's a much happier life. That's the biggest difference. Do you want to be happy or do you want to be rich?
And I can tell you're a very happy guy. So that's good to know. So let's talk. Let's talk about the year of the locust. I think it's best if I have you describe as much as you can about your protagonist, who is Ridley Walker, otherwise known code name Kane, and what mission he is assigned. And I say, I don't want to give anything away, so I'll let you take this as far as you want to go. You know better than anyone how far you can go without ruining this story for our readers.
Well, according to people on Amazon and Goodreads and that, I'm an idiot. And why the hell did he do this? And oh, my God, he got this wrong. So, you know, I'm not the most reliable person to discuss this. But, yes, you're right. His name is Ridley Walker, which is Terry's tip of the hat to a book by Russell Hoven called Ridley Walker, which not a huge selling book, but it's a brilliant piece of creative writing. And I had the great honor of the dead now, unfortunately, but the great honor of meeting Russell Hoven. And I think he wrote just an outstanding book, very difficult, but really outstanding. So I came to write my book and I looking around for a character name and I thought Ridley Walker, and if nothing else, maybe Ridley Scott, the film director, will read it and think, oh, well, his code name's Kane, and he's a denied access area spy. These people really exist. They go into the most terrible places on earth, you know, Yemen, the worst parts of Russia, North Korea, anywhere where you really are not allowed to go as an American intelligence agent. But they do it. Very, very brave men and women, no doubt. And if I was writing it today, part of Kane's background would have been that he'd gone into Gaza on some sort of mission, you know. So it's based on that reality, and he has to go across into the very worst part of Iran, where the border of Iran meets Pakistan and Afghanistan. Now, this is completely lawless. This is, you know, nobody can control this area. And he has to go into that part of Iran and meet a man who is a courier. And if you recall, they tracked Osama bin Laden through the couriers, because any terrorist worth his salt knows not to use any electronic device. The American NSA is so good, they'll get you. And that's so it's weird that the modern form of warfare uses the most primitive form of technology, which is voice. It can't be hacked. You whisper in somebody's ear and it can't be hacked. So they come to learn of a terrorist who's willing to sell them some information. He can't leave Iran. He has to be very careful because he's a dead man walking if anybody finds out. So our hero, Kane, has to go into that part of Iran and rendezvous with him and hear details of a plot which will cause enormous economic damage and great loss of life to the West. Well, of course, he gets there and things don't go quite to plan. He ends up, and this is a spoiler, but I think everybody can anticipate what happens. He doesn't get the information, but he has to run for his life, and he has to run and use all of his ingenuity to stay alive behind enemy lines. Well, that's the first 50 pages.
That's well done. So I want to talk about the landscape for a moment. What I found so impressive about following this guy, Kane, is that I felt like I was there in Iran, in Afghanistan. Your description of the landscape was right on. And I was, you know, I had Google right next to me the whole time I was reading your novel, as I know many readers would, because you're checking all these things that you say really exist, or they don't really exist, or they're going to exist. But on this one, I'm just curious, have you traveled that region? Did you create this area where the crucifixion takes place? And I want to talk about that in a minute. And I know that may sound like a spoiler alert, but I heard that on another one of your interviews, and I think it's a fascinating story. But first of all, tell us how you get there. How do you write about this landscape, either because you've been there or because you haven't?
Well, I had a conversation with a U.S. Special Forces guy a couple of months ago. He read the book. And he said, asked exactly the same question you did. He said, how did you get in? How did you get in? He said, I've been to quite a number of these places, and you are so right on with that. Now, I went in as a special team, a really highly, highly secret special forces team. He said, right. How did you get in there? I said, well, I've got talents which, you know, are not recognized, especially by my family. My kids think I'm useless. They think I just go and sit in this room and surf the internet and maybe write a few things. He said, yeah, but how did you get in there? I said, I didn't. As if I would go into Iran. I mean, I might be sort of not too bright, but I'm not that dumb. I said, no, it's a marriage of research, discussing it with people who have been there, imagination, and projecting yourself into that environment. It's very, very much like acting, where an actor will do, a good actor, you know, I'm talking Meryl Streep, that level, you know, will do all the research. They will think endlessly about the character or the landscape of where this play's happening. And then they come to that moment of performance, and they forget it all, and they just live it. So for my sins, I had the ability, I think, to imagine that I'm trekking across the most god-awful wasteland that, you know, on the planet, and that I'm dying of thirst, and I have to make some very, very critical decisions on which my life will depend. And I have to do that page after page. So it's basically the research, whether that comes from the internet or whether it comes from discussions with people who have been there. But whatever it is, you're looking for what I always think of as the telling detail. You're not looking for the broad strokes of everything about Iran. You're looking for the small details that speak volumes about life in that environment. And you're right. People do read with Google next to them. And my job as a novelist is to make sure I get everything right. I have to tell a million small truths so that the reader will believe the one big lie. And the one big lie is that there's a denied access area spy lost in Iran. in order to get you to believe that, I've got to make sure that crucifixion, you know, really works, that that landscape really works, that the peregrine falcons really are there, and on and on and on. If I can do that, if I can get you to believe all these million small truths, if you Google it all and say, my God, he's right. The trick is to get them to say, well, and what happens to Cain next? I'll read the next paragraph or the next page. That's the trick. So, yeah, I haven't been there. I've been to many, many places. I've traveled enormously in the world. But, you know, I've got four teenage kids, and I do have responsibilities. And that's a really nice way of saying I'm a complete coward.
Well, you're listening to Terry Hayes. He's believable as you can get, and his book is The Year of the Locust. Let's get back to that crucifixion. When I'm reading your book and I think something's going to go wrong here, I suppose from previous spy thrillers, I'm thinking beheading. That's what happens to a lot of them. They get beheaded. But in your case, something else happens, and it's all the fault, or not the fault, but the credit goes to Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Dear Mel. Dear Mel, who I've known since before he was famous, because, you know, I met him on Mad Max all those many, many years ago. And we get to see each other periodically, and I've made a number of movies with Mel, a couple of which I think were pretty good. And anyway, I think I was in Los Angeles. I was in LA and visiting some work-related thing. Anyway, we called each other, and he said, let's have lunch. I said, yes, sure. So we went and had lunch. I think he was shooting downtown, I remember that, in some terrible hotel. So we went and had lunch, and he was in preparation for doing The Passion of the Christ, which is not surprising, because I've had many, many discussions about religion with Mel. And, you know, he's a very devout, very conservative member of the Catholic Church. And so anyway, I said, oh, well, you know, it's a good story. The book sold a lot of copies. I said, the Bible, Mel, that sold a lot of copies. I said, the crucifixion's really the key to the New Testament. He said, yeah, you're right. Do you know anything about crucifixions? I said, well, yeah, I know you don't want to have it done to you. I know that much. And he said, no, do you really know? I said, no, I don't. He said, oh, let me tell you. So he did. We're eating lunch, but it goes on for hours in absolutely graphic detail of what happens to you when you're crucified. Because he had researched all of this for the movie. And so he knew everything from a medical point of view, of what happens to your body during crucifixion. And he said to me, and I use it in the book, it's not an execution. Don't ever make that mistake. Crucifixion is not an execution. It is actually slow motion death by torture. And what happens to you in a crucifixion is, due to the collapse of internal organs, because you're hanging off a cross, you can breathe in, but you can't breathe out. So you actually are slowly suffocating, along with a lot of other catastrophic events. And as we know from the New Testament, you know, Longinus gets his spear and puts Christ out of his agony. That's how awful crucifixion is. So I narratively, narratively in Iran, and the bad guys capture their courier. They unmask him. Well, of course, they're of the Islamic faith and, you know, fundamentalist Islamic followers. And the greatest insult they can bestow upon someone is to treat them as a Christian. These guys, I'm not saying that about Islam, God forbid, I'm not saying that, but these guys. And, of course, what is the iconic image of Christianity? The crucifixion. So this guy who has betrayed them, who has moved well outside their faith, according to them, well, they crucify him. You're no better than a Christian. And that gave me opportunity to draw upon my conversations with Mel and describe it in a way that is perhaps not common in a lot of novels, because, yeah, I did go into the pretty awful detail of it. But then, you know, it's a narrative story. I have to up the ante. It's not, otherwise, yeah. You know, I'm just describing a crucifixion. So I had his wife there watching it, chained to the ground, and nearby his two daughters, 1 6, 1 8, at the foot of the cross, staring up at their father. So it gets pretty intense. From my point of view as a novelist, that could all be seen as quite gratuitous. I did Road Warrior. I got lots of comments about gratuitous violence. But in this case, it wasn't, because our hero, Payne, is on a ridgeline watching this. Mm-hmm. And he has a rifle. And he's not the best shot in the world. But that is a pretty good rifle. And it's got a scope on it. Now he's facing a moral dilemma. The CIA says, without doubt, you have to leave. Their rules are quite clear. The mission is blown. It's over. You turn tail and go home. Yeah, he's an agent, but he's also a man, a human being, and he's got a rifle. And there's only three guards. There's hundreds of people watching, all in various states of distress. There's only three guards. And he's got a rifle with a scope. What do you do? That's the interesting thing to me. That characterizes a man, whether he follows his humanity or he follows his career, whether he follows the rules of the CIA or the rules of life. So I like the scene. It sort of worked for me. Thanks, Mel.
Well, it's certainly a description that should tempt our readers to run right out and get the book, because that was beautifully done. And by the way, I must say, I grew up a Catholic, and I've never heard any priest ever describe what a crucifixion really is the way you just did. In a sense, it ought to make better Catholics out of those who are reading your novel, given that's a pretty tough description there. But let's move on to, I'm almost out of time, Terry, but I do want to give you an opportunity to talk. First of all, I Am Pilgrim comes first, then comes The Year of the Locust, not a sequel to I Am Pilgrim for sure. But the question arises, aside from the film that's coming out on I Am the Pilgrim, what's Terry Hayes going to do next? What happens?
Well, I was very, very tired during the last stages of Year of the Locust. Really, really exhausted. Sick of research, sick of these characters, sick of picking up non-cliched things, sick of my kids, arguing with my wife. And the publisher in England, a guy called Bill Scott Carr, who is a friend of mine, recognized this psychological and emotional weakness. And he called me and he said, well, do you want to make a fair amount of money? And I said, why is that? He said, well, there's an opportunity. There is really an opportunity. I said, yeah. He said, you know, do whatever you like, but you're sounding very, very upset, very exhausted, and maybe you'd like to take a very nice holiday or buy a good car or something like that. And I said, oh, yeah, Bill, that's really nice of you. He said, yeah, all you got to do is agree to write I Am Pilgrim 2. I said, oh. And he said, yeah, it'll be huge. He said, and you're really silly if you don't do it. And he said, do you have a story? I said, yeah, I do, actually, because I'm always thinking stories. Sure. So that's what we did. At a moment of terrible vulnerability, I was exploited by the publishing industry. Greed reared its ugly head. I love cars. Don't care much about houses and lots of other things, but I do like cars. And And he knew that because I often talked about cars. And that, and so this moment, this terrible moment in my life, he said, do you want to do it? I said, yes. And now that's what I'm living with, Bob. I'm living with my weakness and all of that. But I'm having a lot of fun with it. I do love that character in Pilgrim. And in Pilgrim 2, I'm not chasing a terrorist. I've had it with the terrorists. I have done my bit to warn the world about what we face. And now I'm off in a totally different landscape for my hero from Pilgrim to be dragged out of retirement and have to go into a pretty frightening part of the world. And so it's a good mission. Nice people. Well, not all nice people, but people I know quite well. And I'm in the midst of plotting all that out at the moment. We've got some great scenes, some really good scenes, and that's always a good start. You know, it's like in Locust. I knew what the crucifixion would be like. I knew that he'd end up in a cage, being taken to be drowned in the Persian Gulf. I knew lots of things about it, and that's what I'm doing at the moment. So I'm trying to cobble all this together, and I'm excited by it.
Any idea when we could expect that?
Oh God, well, you seem like such a nice man. You did. What isn't this pleasant? We're having like a fireside chat, but of course, out comes the knife. 2 years.
All right.
Well, my good friend Bill from England wrote into the contract that if I don't deliver on time, I have to pay quite substantial financial penalties. So the car recedes farther and farther into the distance the longer I So I've got my skates on. I'm going fast.
All right. Well, I tell you, Terry, after all the people I've ever interviewed on this show, this has been the most interesting, the most fun. I've so much enjoyed. In fact, if you and I were in the same room, I'd buy you a pint for what you've done here at Reader's Corner. I want to remind everybody again, his name is Terry Hayes. He's written I Am Pilgrim in 2014. We had to wait 10 years for it, but it's now the year of the locust. And I'll tell you what, it is a very, very thrilling book, but let's call it an adventure book and close this interview. Terry Hayes, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun. Thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.